This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of Worldwide Wave, the international LGBT news and current affairs show, every week on Australia's first LGBT radio station, Joy 94.9.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community. This is the Worldwide Wave.
It is Worldwide Wave, Joy's international news and current affairs show. We take you around the globe one country at a time. In the studio tonight, Paul is here.
Hello.
Tom is helping push the buttons along with Damien and myself, Matt.
Hello.
Now, 2016 has been a big year in LGBTI rights, from battles on the floor of the United Nations, same-sex marriage fights, violence and shootings, pride marches, and some amazing, inspiring stories. We have captured a snapshot of change in LGBTI rights throughout the people that we speak to each week right here on this show. So over the next 2 weeks, we're going to take you on a walk down memory lane and revisit some of the best interviews of 2016.
Tonight, we are revisiting Andre Duplessis from ILGA, the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans and Intersex Association, who advocates for our rights at the United Nations.
Didi Otomo from Gaya Nasatraya, for the rapid rise in hate speech against Indonesia's gay community.
Robert Beachy, he's an expert on German history who enlightened us on Berlin's vibrant gay scene in the late 1800s and early 1900s.
Jeff Prostrysko from Orlando Pride on the post-Pulse shooting recovery.
From France, Ludwig Mohamed Zahid, the first gay, openly gay imam.
And Ray Jung, whose passion and determination keep the Hong Kong Lesbian and Gay Film Festival going and keeping it from closure. Here's a taste of what's coming up tonight.
When we first started in 2000, it was really difficult to find any gay Asian stories. I think you have one or two, and, you know, usually a lot of the time they use a lot of, like, eye candies, you know, in order to make it, you know, more attractive. And now I think it's a lot more diverse.
This is Ryan Reed from the International Gay Rodeo Association, saddling up with Worldwide Wave on Joy 94.9.
Now, it's a little bit of a different format from usual. We are recapping the best of 2016. And in February, we actually celebrated a milestone. It was our 200th show, which seems like so long ago. And for this special occasion, we went straight to the top, to the corridors of the United Nations, to discover what goes on behind the scenes at the world level to advocate for LGBTI rights. We spoke with Andre Duplessis. He is the UN Program and Advocacy Manager for ILGA, the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans and Intersex Association. Andre explained how ILGA advocates for LGBT inclusion in policies and discussions at the United Nations, and we asked him how far-reaching the implications such inclusions are.
Well, and again, we see it at different levels. So we do have moments when the world governments have voted on LGBT. We saw that in 2011 when South Africa brought a resolution on sexual orientation and gender identity, which is the kind of the way of talking about LGBT within the UN. They brought that and they brought a vote and it passed by a slight margin. We were very happy it passed, but it wasn't very strong. 3 years later, we had Brazil and others brought a resolution and the margin of support increased hugely. We're not a huge majority, but we are now, more countries than not are now saying that we should talk about these issues. So that frames the international discourse. It might sound like a really small thing, but what happens is there now is a letterhead which has the UN logo at the top and saying, yep, more governments than not have voted to discuss LGBT issues.
Andre, as much as we'd love to see that change tomorrow, it can only be a good thing that the dialogue's now being opening at a government level and across the globe, not just in a handful of countries.
Absolutely. And we're seeing that change happening. I think if you looked at the UN 10 years ago, you would have had only, you know, North American potentially, but not even their countries talking about it, European, Australia, you would have a handful of basically Western countries prepared to engage in the discussion. And we've seen huge changes happening. In my own country, I come from South Africa. I'm, you know, very proud that there's a country in Africa now taking these issues on. We're seeing Nepal, Thailand, the Philippines, the whole of Latin America has effectively come on board as well. So, yeah, we do see like little changes taking place. And that's just reflective of what's happening on the ground in so many places around the world.
The countries that most need change are probably the ones least likely to talk to you and talk about LGBTI issues. How do you engage with them? Africa, for example.
Well, I think we'd be surprised, actually, at how much discussion is going on. And I think there's often an assumption that Africa is the worst place in the world to be LGBT. And, yeah, of course, there are some horrendous things going on across the continent. But it goes to the diversity of our movement as well. You know, we're LGBT and I. That there's some horrible stuff going on sexual orientation, gender identity in Uganda, Nigeria, of course. But we're also keen as a, you know, to point out the, you know, in Europe, so many countries across this continent, trans people are still being required to be sterilized before they can actually change their legal documents for gender recognition. So I just want to start out by saying that we really try to make sure that we don't paint it as, you know, the West is best and then, you know, the rest of the world is this horrible place where nothing's happening. So we often don't talk with the difficult governments, and you're right that some in Africa, some in Asia in particular, are some of them are openly hostile against us. We won't necessarily publicly have conversations facing off with them, and rather we'd try and work with them behind the scenes. We'd talk with them quietly, like, can you perhaps abstain from this resolution? Can you perhaps not come out with some particularly strong rhetoric? And also, crucially, we will work always with the local NGOs in the country. So if we're wanting to talk with Malawi, let's say, then we would talk with Malawian LGBT NGOs and other NGOs to make sure that the message we're getting through to them is happening appropriately and that it doesn't harm any of the groups on the ground there.
We've spoken about some of those negatives. How important can the positives be, if you like, a domino effect when one country leads the way? And I'm thinking in Africa, we've had Mozambique decriminalizing just recently the former president of Botswana speaking out in support of LGBTI mm-hmm. rights. How can that be used to encourage other countries to start down the path towards equality?
What we're really excited about is being you know, the African, in Mozambique, the NGO there, Lambda, is the one who really worked for decades to bring about change and worked within Mozambique, talking with their government. They would come to the UN and raise issues publicly about their own government here. And as a result, I think they built up relationships over the years. And yeah, exactly, Mozambique decriminalized last year. We find that the best change is happening when it is local groups talking, and we see that happening increasingly across the continent. Yes, you've highlighted Botswana as well. So for us, it's making sure that voices within the region are empowered to help bring that about.
Does ILGA have members in some of those countries that are, I guess, dragging the chain or really lagging behind, or do you have to come at it from a completely external point of view?
We have a lot of member organizations in some of the toughest places around the world. You know, Uganda, Nigeria, we have very strong LGBTI movements. Those would be some of the two most hostile places in Africa. You know, you look at places like India, which has recriminalized homosexuality, and yet there's huge numbers of LGBTI groups there. So we do have presences in those places. Now, you might get to some of the most hostile places on the planet. You might come to somewhere like Saudi Arabia or the UAE. In those places, no, we don't have any groups actually in those countries. In those situations, yeah, we are working with the women's rights movements, for example, recognizing that gender equality is often the beginning to erode for broader equality, particularly for LGBTI people. So we would recognize you can't go into Riyadh at the moment and try and hold a gay pride, right? You've got to actually to start from a place much further back. And support, okay, let's try and support the women's movement. Let's try and support gender equality there.
That was André Duplessis from ILGA speaking to us from Switzerland. This is 2016's Best of Worldwide Wave.
Joy, 94.9.
This is David Odari from the Ubuntu Foundation, Malawi, Southern Africa, on the Worldwide Wave on Joy 94.9.
Couple of messages coming in on Facebook, one about the Nigerian ambassador who reckons economic inducements are turning kids gay. Fenella says, idiota. Simple. We are doing a bit of a best of tonight, and we are now off to Indonesia, where for much of 2016, Indonesia's LGBTI community has been under attack. Politicians have been openly speaking out against them, and religious groups are up in arms. Even the local psychiatric association has joined the chorus of anti-gay sentiment. For an insider's view of what is happening and what is driving such change in anti-gay rhetoric, we spoke to Didi Utomo. He's the founder and trustee of Gaya Nusantara, which is Indonesia's oldest LGBT rights organisation. We asked Didi if he has a sense of what is driving this negativity.
A few things. One of them is actually just before this, there was the bomb in Jakarta, right? And every time there's a bomb, the Islamists always feel, or even actually some Muslims feel that, oh, you know, we're being targeted for Islamophobic statements and stuff like that. So this is actually sort of the backlash. They fight back. And this way, they look, they're a moralist, they're clean, they're good guys. So that's one. Number two, the Islamist parties have been losing votes, especially in the regional elections happening in December. So another one is happening like next year, and then there's another one. So anyway, every year there's some kind of, you know, series of elections anyway. So they're trying to recoup that. The other thing is, my sense is that the Islamists, well, the Christians are sort of tailing behind that in a more quiet way. And the sort of old so-called New Order forces from the Suharto years are joining hands together now, and they find a common enemy that is easy, useful, weak, because for them, of the communist scare, the Red Scare, was getting to be dated and really stale. That's actually putting them kind of on the spot. And so they're fighting back by uniting in nationalism, everything, by targeting LGBT people.
Some of the claims are fairly serious. Mm-hmm. Some of the religious groups are calling for the recriminalization of homosexuality, which we've seen recently in India. How serious do you take that threat?
It's really serious. I mean, the rhetoric has been around since the 80s, actually. We inherited the criminal code of the Dutch East Indies that was quite liberal in terms of sexuality. That was, of course, you know, kind of put together actually by Napoleon Bonaparte in the early 19th century. So, I mean, I was warned, I remember, by my good friend, the lawyer, Nushaba Nikatasantana, in the 90s already, that this is coming. And well, I did heed the warning, and I looked at what's happening in Parliament. But our Parliament is lazy, and there's not much money, I think, to be made by revising the criminal code, but you never know. I mean, if there's a big funder, most of our parliamentarians are corrupt. If you don't give them, like, you know, special money, they're not going to pass the bill. Although if they find this to be convenient and useful for their purposes, they will pass it. So we take it seriously. What is encouraging is actually the resistance. There is a caucus in Parliament called the Pancasila Caucus. Pancasila is the, I don't have an idea how strong it is, but it's there. Top human rights lawyers have actually condemned the potential, well, certainly the discriminatory rhetoric and the potential human rights violations. You know, freedom of expression, certainly freedom of assembly, and you know, basically your right to life. Some people might be killed. But, you know, we have to look at this as part of a whole series of intolerance toward religious minorities, Ahmadi, Shiite Christians, and in Christian areas, Sunni Muslims, toward survivors of 65. So anybody who's marginal in Indonesia should be worried. There is talk amongst people who are more savvy about this that the next target will be women, I mean the feminists. You can already see it, you know. One flash mob, you know, 1 billion rising in Yogyakarta, I mean, against the violence against women, was attacked by some Islamist mob the other day. So this is the whole scheme of actually the old forces, ironically called the New Order, trying to take back what they lost in 98.
That's Didi Utomo, a very persistent and dedicated campaigner for LGBTI rights in Indonesia.
Next, we're off to Germany. We're meant to learn from our past, and Germany's history has not always been kind to the gay community. But there was a time when Berlin was the gay center of the world. In the late 1800s and 1900s, or early 1900s, Berlin was not only a decadent and very gay center, it was also attracting academics with new ideas on sexuality and gender. We spoke to Robert Beachy, the author of the book called Gay Berlin, Birthplace of a Modern Identity. He was speaking to us from South Korea. He took us back to a time when gay journals and periodicals were sold openly in the streets, gay bars flourished, and leading academics began to talk scientifically about homosexuality.
I think probably most people have the impression, if they know something about the period at all, that Germany would have been a pretty repressive and conservative place. And I think that's, you know, accurate to a certain extent. But there was also a great deal going on, you could say, just below the surface. Berlin especially was just an amazingly dynamic city because it was the new capital of this newly unified Germany only since 1871. And it was also expanding just with incredible speed. So the population doubled about every 10 or 15 years over the course of maybe 40 years. And so in, you know, this 15, 20-year period leading up to the outbreak of the First World War, there was a lot going on. There was lots and lots of growth, but also along with that, a lot of dislocation. There was this huge new German working class that was growing in Berlin. There was amazing industry. Berlin in this period was sometimes described as the Silicon Valley of, you know, the late 19th, early 20th century. So there was just a great deal of economic dynamism. But I think what this created also was a certain sort of anonymity, which made it possible for people to experiment in ways maybe that they wouldn't have been able to do in either a smaller city or maybe another European capital that was more established or that wasn't as dynamic or growing as rapidly.
It was a pretty decadent town, though, really.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. For one thing, I think there wasn't the same sort of established church that you would have found in either Paris or London. There was no equivalent of the Church of England exactly. There was no Catholic Church. And I think that also created a certain sense of tolerance and toleration. There's one other really important factor here, and that is the kinds of policies that were developed by the Berlin police specifically. And fairly early on, already in the 1880s, they decided that as a pragmatic issue, it wasn't really a good idea to try to prevent different sorts of bars or cafes from appealing to or catering to what appeared to be a homosexual or in some cases a lesbian public. And so these kinds of establishments were actually allowed to operate fairly openly where people could congregate without fear of some kind of arrest or a raid. And this was also something I think that Berlin was probably unique for, at least compared to a lot of other places in Europe at this point.
Joy 94.9.
Hi, this is Darren from MyGWork, the global recruitment hub for LGBT professionals, speaking to you from London on the World Wide Wave.
A message in on Facebook. This one's about the story about the Cherokee Nation now recognising same-sex marriage. A contrary view, Sonia says, just more colonisation concepts to assimilate First Nations. Indigenous nations have their own sexualities and don't need further loss of identity. Interesting, the other side of the coin.
Now, no show on LGBT issues from 2016 would be complete without a mention of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, Florida. It was the worst attack on the LGBTIQ community in US history, claiming 49 innocent lives. But is it possible that through this tragedy, good might come from it?
And at the time, we spoke with Terry DiCarlo from the GLBT Centre in Orlando, and they were providing crisis counselling and support. We also spoke with Jeff Prostrico, and he's from Come Out With Pride, the organisers of Orlando Pride. To paint a picture, it was about 36 hours after the shooting had occurred, and while emotions were still raw and details were still hazy, Jeff gave us a really good insight into how Orlando and its LGBT community were coping.
I think, obviously, everyone is dealing with this in their own way. Certainly, there are people who knew a lot of the victims, and if they didn't, regardless. Everyone here is a deep sense of sadness and sorrow. But at the same time, the community truly is coming together. And the LGBT community, all of the various organizations between Pride, our local LGBT center, Equality Florida, HRC, so many other groups and organizations have joined forces to bring help to those in need, setting up donation pages to make sure that the victims and their families are taken care of. But really, beyond that, there has been such incredible showing of support from the allies and the straight community as well. So there's a lot that people around here are doing and making sure that, you know, Orlando is going to come back. We're going to heal from this, and we're going to be a strong community.
One of the ways people are showing support is blood donations, and we're seeing images of very long lines of people queuing up to help out in that particular way. Is that causing some pain within the LGBT community in that there are restrictions on blood donation, I understand?
Absolutely. You know, so even though the law technically changed last year, it is still very unfair towards the majority of gay men and women. And that's something that a lot of LGBT groups are fighting for. That's something that we're trying to change. And, you know, if there is a positive to hopefully come out of this awful tragedy, it's that more and more people will become aware of the irony of the situation. When you saw the lines, I heard anywhere from some places had 7 to even 10 hours of wait to donate blood. Most of those people, if not the majority, vast majority, were our straight allies. And I think they're going to, you know, it was a shock to them, not because a lot of them don't know that that law exists. And, you know, we're educating people. We're letting them know that this is a huge issue, and this is going to bring a lot of attention to that. And I'm sure it's going to have a lot of conversation over the next couple of months. And I'm confident that there's going to be some positive change in effect.
That healing process, it's probably going to be more of a marathon than a sprint. How do you start that healing process? And I'm even thinking in terms of your upcoming Pride event, which is essentially a celebration. Does that now change the way you are looking at your Pride event?
Absolutely. Our Pride event is in October every year. There was just a large Gay Days event last weekend here in Orlando. So our event is typically held a few months after that. Yeah, the mood is no doubt going to change. There's no question about that. And we're going to be at another sister Pride in 2 weeks. There's a sister city, St. Pete, that's about 2 hours away from us. And we'll be leaving the parade. And it's going to be a very, I'm sure, sad affair. But we also want to make sure that we're remembering and honoring those that we've lost, celebrating their lives. You know, the LGBT community has had Pride celebrations for decades. And none of those years, in any of those years, was there ever a year when there wasn't some kind of awful news or there weren't plenty of attacks on LGBT folks. So despite all of the things that happen, I think we as a community come together in a situation like that with a need to recognize everything that happened, but at the same time, try to learn, try to grow from it, and just try to enjoy being part of that community together. That's a significant part of why Pride exists. And for as long as there's going to continue to be homophobia in the world and parents who reject their children for coming out, we will continue to have Pride, and it will continue to be a huge part of people's lives.
That's Jeff Prostrico from Orlando Pride. That show remains one of our most listened to podcasts and one of our favourite shows of the year, and you can hear that at joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
We also recently went back to Orlando to hear some of the very positive changes that the city and its people have embraced on their long road to recovery. This is Worldwide Wave.
Want to hear more? Find out about LGBT life in over 100 countries. Download free podcasts of this show. Subscribe to iTunes or follow us on Twitter. Visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
Hi, this is Tamás from Hatay Society, fighting for the human rights of the LGBTQI community in Hungary on the worldwide wave.
We actually had a message in last week that didn't quite come through while we were on air. So thank you, Florence, for that message. And we are going to contact Kaleidoscope and get them on the show again early in the new year. We are doing our best of 2016 tonight. And we went to France, where we looked at the issue of being gay and Muslim. Homosexuality is illegal and culturally condemned in just about every Muslim-dominated country, and it's not an environment that, you know, you would think would bring together religion and sexuality. But one Algerian man has reconciled being gay and Muslim and went on to found the world's first gay-friendly mosque in France. Ludwig Mohamed Zahid, he is the world's first gay imam, joined us to tell us his story from coming out to his parents, firstly as gay, and later as HIV positive.
It was a problem when I did my coming out. They finally accepted my sexual orientation. But it's true that my mother, for years after that, she was hoping that I was going to meet a girl that was suiting my desires and so on. It never happened, of course. And when she learned that I was HIV positive, she didn't cry or anything. She told me, at least that's a disease that we can cure or we can take care of. So for her, being HIV positive was less problematic than being homosexual. And then later on, 10 years later, when I was around 30 years old, she understood it was not a disease. I was a well-balanced human being, doing a lot for others and so on. So studying and working and so on. So she was convinced after 10 years that I was kind of okay to be gay, but it took her an entire decade to understand that I can have a happy life.
Now let's talk a bit about your journey of bringing together your sexuality and your religion, because many people who have negative experiences with religion and its views on homosexuality choose to walk away. But you've stayed with your religion and indeed taken up a leadership position. What made you want to do that?
After I left Algeria in 97, after the civil war, I decided to leave Islam also, because for me, Islam was the main problem. It was religion, the big devil. Then I understood later on when I did my PhD in psychology and another one in anthropology that the true problem, the root of the problematic here in terms of state homophobia and societal homophobia is more related to economics and intellectual emancipation. So when I left Islam, because of perhaps bad reasons, but also because it was too much for me to handle, I was so young, at 17 years old, I was an atheist for 7 years, and then I got back to Islam, to spirituality, through Buddhism, through meditation and so on, because something was missing in my life. Something I knew I had, that mesmerizing representation of life I had when I was a teenager, when I was praying as a Muslim. So through Buddhism, I understood two things. Islam is not the problem, because you also find homophobia within Buddhist communities or Christians or Jewish or even atheist communities. The problem is what you do. Well, how do we handle Islam? As a spirituality, not as a political ideology anymore. So we have to evolve from that point of view. And the second thing is that I can also share that liberating representation of Islam with other people, perhaps, who need to be informed of those problematics in detail to be able to free themselves from homophobia in their families, in their communities, and so on. So that's what I did in 2010, founding the first gay Muslim organization in France. And then we, 2 years later, we founded the first European Inclusive Mosque in Paris in 2012, because more and more even straight people came to us telling us, the Islam that you talk about, that's the true Islam. That's what we want to believe in, a humanistic, inclusive, universal Islam. So that was the moment where they asked me, because I studied religion to become an imam, they pushed me forward, and they told me, you have to train us to become imams like you.
Ludwig Muhammad Zahed telling his story of bringing together his sexuality with his Muslim religion.
When Hong Kong was handed back to China in 1997, there was a great concern about what this meant for the local LGBT community. There was a fear that hard-won acceptance might be lost. So retaining LGBT culture was seen as vital. Ray Young was a lawyer who turned his hand to queer Asian cinema. He was one of the people responsible for reviving the Hong Kong Lesbian and Gay Film Festival under Chinese rule. We asked Ray if he felt there was a positive change towards greater acceptance of the LGBT people in Hong Kong.
Yeah, things have changed a lot. I think much, much better now. I think with globalization, you know, people travel a lot more, and so also the culture, you know, opening up a lot more, emails, and people get to know more people from different culture and different backgrounds. I think open up a lot more, definitely. I think it's great because, like, a lot of the times, you know, about any kind of prejudice is really just getting to know someone, understand them, and when they become friends, then you no longer carry a lot of that stereotypes that you have of people like that. So I think even though in the majority, well, certainly in a lot of the more developed, you know, cities, you know, being gay is no longer an issue. And I think in the gay scene, certainly, I think there are a lot more people who are willing to date Asian people or Asians dating Asians. Although you still see on the Grindr or something like that, that people actually dare to say no blacks or no Asians, which up to this day, I still think, really? Hold on, you are gay. You should know about these kind of things. Why do you put things like that? Why can't you just say that? Well, anyway, you don't have to say anything. If people send you a message, it's a compliment. You just don't have to answer it. I don't know why people have to be basically mean, you know? And it doesn't make... Well, they think that makes them better, I guess. I don't know why.
You're a lawyer.
Yes.
By trade or originally. How did you get into making queer films?
Yes, I was doing a lot of soliciting, that's why. No, well, you know, I was... You see, a good Chinese boy, right? Because your parents always want you to be a lawyer or a doctor, and I, you know, from Hong Kong, and again, you know, they want me to live at the peak, so therefore they wanted me to be a lawyer. So I did that, you know, and then, but it was never really something I wanted to do. And of course, you know, I also wanted to have a voice, like I said, being a minority. And with the law, a lot of the times, you are basically just working for the ruling class, really. So, you know, so there was a lot of things that when I was doing law that I wasn't really happy about anyway.
You've been involved in setting up and the ongoing commitment to the Hong Kong Lesbian and Gay Film Festival. What makes it important for a place like Hong Kong to have a vibrant gay film festival?
Well, the Hong Kong Lesbian Gay Film Festival actually started in 1989, and that was a time that when being gay was not legal in Hong Kong. And that went on, and then the law changed, and then in 1997, the festival stopped. And that was the time when it was hangover to China. And I think the organization was a bit sensitive about that, and also the economy was very bad at that time. So they used the excuse of saying that, oh, well, because the economy is bad, so we can't run it anymore. So that was the time that when I moved back to Hong Kong, so I decided to restart the film festival in year 2000. And that's when I started involved, you know, stuff like 2000. And the first few years was really tough because we didn't really have a lot of funding at all. So, you know, the ticket sale basically have to cover the festival cost. And it was important because we were hanging back to China. I didn't want that after that. After a period of time, it would be really difficult to restart the festival. So I wanted to restart it as soon as possible so that at least that it exists, so that when the Chinese, if they really came to rule the place, then we already say that, hey, this already exists. It's a big deal if you want to change something that's already existed for a while. So that was the reason that why we had to do it.
Receive LGBT news from around the world throughout the week, like World Wide Wave on Facebook now.
Hi, this is Tara from the Fiji Women's Rights Movement on the World Wide Wave.
It's Joy's International News and Current Affairs show, taking you around the globe one country at a time. We've really enjoyed bringing you a bit of the best of tonight, but wait, There's more, because next week there's more best. A big thank you to all of our guests tonight across the year and across the globe. You can revisit these shows on podcast. We cover LGBT life from about 140-odd countries so far. Go to our website at joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
We would love to thank everyone that's interacted with us on Facebook. You know, Trent, Tara, Clara, Shannon, and there's a heap more. That's W3Joy on Facebook.
A big shout out to Marcello from North Fitzroy, who's just joined the Joy family. Thanks, Marcello. And also to Tom, who's here training on the panel tonight. Good work, Tom.
Thank you.
And not forgetting Gordon out on the front desk, dealing with all the calls.
Waving to Gordon. We need some music to take us out.
It's a woman's world, apparently.
On World Wide Wave.
Thanks for listening to another podcast of World Wide Wave, the show that takes you around the globe one country at a time. World Wide Wave is the international news and current affairs show on Australia's LGBT radio station, Joy 94.9. You can listen live every Tuesday night from 7 p.m. Eastern Australian Time on 94.9 FM in Melbourne or online at joy.org.au. You'll find all of our podcasts at joy.org.au/worldwidewave. Or follow us on Facebook for the latest international LGBT news. Search W3Joy on Facebook now.
Great shows, great topics, great radio. Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.